This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Linda Mates. Linda is an environmental reporter for the Seattle Times and author of several books, including Elwha, A River Reborn, and Breaking Ground. Linda Mates is here to tell us about her most recent book, Witness Tree, Seasons of Change with a Century-Old Oak, published in 2017. She researched and wrote Witness Tree while a Knight Fellow in Science Journalism at MIT and a Bullard Fellow in Forest Research, in residence with her oak at the Harvard Forest. Welcome, Linda.
Thank you, Diane. It's great to be back.
What led you to write Witness Tree? What is your purpose?
I wanted people to understand the wonder, the beauty, and the importance of trees. Earth Day, it's a really good day to go out and look at your favorite tree and really appreciate what it does for us. None of us could exist on this earth without trees. We have shared breath with trees. The CO2 that we exhale is the food that they take in to make their leaves, their branches, their roots. We're actually linked by our shared breath.
You were in the Harvard Forest for your residency. What is the history of the Harvard Forest? Why was it set up?
It's so interesting that a lot of people have never even heard of the Harvard Forest at Harvard. It's this little-known gem out in central Massachusetts, about 2 hours from Cambridge. And it was formed in 1907 to be a place where scientists, well, at the beginning, students, could learn about forests. And, you know, over that time, the forest grew and grew in size to now more than 4,000 acres of natural native New England woods. But everywhere you look, you're very quickly reminded that this is more than just a forest. You see tagging, you see flagging, you see all kinds of strange devices. You hear drones zipping overhead. This is actually an outdoor classroom and library with scientists and researchers and students from all over the world convened to study everything from carbon sequestration to landscape history.
What is known about how the area where the Harvard Forest is located has changed over time?
This is one of the things that really attracted me to this story. This used to be the classic New England farmland from the time of Thoreau. He wrote at the height of deforestation in New England, and indeed, the Harvard Forest today is an incredible rewilding story because people walked away from those farms in the 1860s to go work in the factories to create the emissions that are now changing our world. And all of this six-state area of New England has regrown to forest. And in that transformation has come a transformation of wildlife. All the animals that Thoreau lamented were gone, the so-called nobler animals, the big ones, the bear, the moose, they were gone. And you know what? Today, they're back in their forest home, which has regrown to a glorious woodland.
Would you say more about the research activities that go on in the Harvard Forest?
What's so interesting about the Harvard Forest is everything is going on there. They bring in writers and artists to tell the story of the forest and why it matters and its ever-changing ecology. They have very pointy-headed, very specialized scientists from all over the world looking at everything from the gas exchange in the canopy between the leaves and the atmosphere, the sequestration of carbon in the roots of trees. By the way, what's going on underneath the ground? You'll walk along and you'll see a PVC pipe with a screw-off top jammed in the ground, and you'll think, I wonder what that is. And then one day I found out because the researcher who's using that device unscrewed the end and stuck in a camera to look at the actual roots in the ground and understand how fast they were growing, what other kinds of mycorrhizal fungi were there. Literally a camera watching roots grow. So this is the kind of place it is. There are bank security cameras up on towers to watch not for thieves or robbers, but to watch the tree canopy, to watch it go through its seasonal changes every single day of the year with real images in real time uploaded every half hour so you can actually watch spring come. Here in Seattle, if I want to see my tree, the tree that I lived in, all I have to do is type in the Harvard Forest webcam webpage. And there it is, the Witness Tree, because MIT put one of these cameras underneath my tree so I can watch it go through its seasonal year.
Why did you decide to focus on an individual tree in the Harvard Forest?
That was the joy of this experience. It really was pure discovery. When I went to MIT for my fellowship in science journalism, I was interested in telling the climate change story differently, to get away from dueling politicians and press releases and really try to tell this story through the beautiful, quiet testimony of living things. And at that point, when I was at Harvard and MIT for that fellowship, I just looked around for someone, anyone, who was studying what's called phenology, which is the study of regularly occurring seasonal events in nature. What do I mean by that? I mean singing frogs in spring. I mean bird migrations. I mean the coming of the first leaves. And paying attention to that seasonal cycle tells us what's going on in the living world. So I thought, I'll find someone who's studying that. And I did. I found a professor at Harvard named Andrew Richardson, whose lab was focused on the tree canopy and the seasonal changes in the tree canopy and the timing of those changes and how, because of our warming climate, we see the seasonal timing changing. Spring is earlier, fall is later, winter is squeezed on both ends. And so what did I do? I went out on their field work at the Harvard Forest, and I very quickly discovered John O'Keefe, who'd been studying the same 50 trees for 25 years, walking a loop, watching their seasonal progression, keeping careful notes. And I thought, aha, I need to go on these walks with John, and even better, I need a tree as a way to look at this global phenomena of climate change very up close and personal. Because, in fact, you can see climate change even in one tree.
Why did you choose a red oak as your witness tree?
It's interesting. I love that question. We actually auditioned trees. I wrote to John early on in our adventures, and I said, John, I need a tree. And so we went out on our loop, the survey loop, and we looked at a goosefoot maple. And I thought, well, I love this tree. I love the color of its leaves in the fall. I love its tresses of seeds in the spring. But it was too small, and it didn't have any age, so we moved on. And then we came to the oldest tree in the Harvard Forest. It's about 500 years old, and it's a strange tree that people wouldn't really know. It's a black gum, and it was just too unfamiliar to people. I wanted to write about a tree that people could relate to, that maybe they had in their own yard. And so we kept walking, and then suddenly John puts his hand on this big, beautiful red oak, and he says, here, I think this might be a good one for you. And I tip my head back and I see how big it is, how grand it is, how beautiful it is. And oak is the most common tree species in the Northern Hemisphere. And I thought, that's the tree for me.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Linda Mapes, environmental reporter for the Seattle Times and author of the book Witness Tree, Seasons of Change with a Century-Old Oak. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. Would you say a few more words about the red oak?
So the oak is about 85 feet high, and its crown spread is about 65 feet. And it is the largest tree in its grove. And it was sprouted as a wild sprout from an acorn next to a stone wall. And we double-checked its age by coring it. Scientists can take very tiny cores, so thin that they would fit inside a drinking straw, to bore into the tree's trunk and count the rings under a microscope and understand how many years that tree has been on this earth. And indeed, we cored the tree and we checked it under a microscope, and it was more than 100 years old, which is what I wanted. That took us back to at least 1905, and that's when Model Ts first started rumbling off the assembling line. It's when people started converting from organic, simple agricultural techniques to the kind of petrochemical style agricultures that's practiced today. It's when people began leaving rural areas to live in cities and work in factories. In other words, our whole relationship with nature changed, and indeed, the uptick in carbon emissions into the atmosphere, CO2, began in earnest. It started in 1750, and it accelerated greatly, basically in my lifetime, beginning in about 1950. And this tree has been on this earth witnessing all these changes since about 1905. And so for me, it was a beautiful tree in and of itself, a beautiful wildlife in a lovely native woodland. But it was also a witness to all this history, which is where the name of the book comes from, Witness Tree. It's actually a metaphorical witness tree. In colonial times, people actually marked the boundaries of property with very large trees if they didn't have another kind of marker that was handy. Those were called witness trees. And to me, this is a metaphorical witness tree of our changing world.
What did you notice about the relation of your red oak to the rest of the forest and the creatures within it?
This was one of my most favorite things. No writer writes their books alone. We do this with the help of experts, and I wound up encountering my tree with a whole series of different people, wildlife biologists, people who knew the life of the soil, professional tree climbers, carpenters, dendrologists, all kinds of people. I brought them to my tree for what I called tree soirees, to encounter the tree together. And one of my very favorite people to talk to was an expert, believe it or not, in the ecology of blue jays and squirrels and acorns. He had actually studied the relationship between wildlife and acorns in New England. And what he learned about this relationship between oak trees and animals was fascinating. I mean, first of all, more than 100 vertebrate species utilize the acorns of oak trees. It is a fiesta in the forest when those acorns start to come down. And so what I learned as well is that squirrels are incredibly discerning about the acorns that they gather. They actually give them a little tiny shake to check and see if there's a weevil inside, because if there is, the nutrition they're looking for has already been eaten. And the shake is so fast, they had to slow down their video cameras to actually see what they were doing. The other thing they learned, and I love this, anytime you walk into a room and you can't remember why you went there, did you go there to pick up your keys or whatever? Think of this for a minute. So this researcher told me that he actually caged live squirrels for as long as 3 weeks to see if they would remember where they had buried their acorns. And then he would release them and zoom, zip, zap, right to the spot where they had left them 3 weeks earlier. Obviously, their memory is not perfect, because that's how we get more oak trees, because they forget where they left their acorn. And fortunately, those acorns sprout. But they remember enough of them to be sustained at this bounty in the forest. And deer eat acorns, bear eat acorns. Blue jays are the long distance dispersers, which is very important for the oaks. They have to get their acorn away from the canopy of the parent tree because they need sunshine. And so these beautiful, glorious blue jays that you see swooping through the sky on a beautiful fall afternoon, they're on a mission. They're taking that acorn they just picked up to their nest in the forest, maybe a mile distant. So there's a very intimate, elaborate web of life that depends on the acorn that comes in the fall from these trees. It takes 2 years for the acorn to develop, and the size of the crop varies in years that are called mast years, M-A-S-T. There's a very big set of the crop, and there'll be so many acorns that the animals cannot eat them all, which is a strategy that the tree uses, because in a mast year, that's when lots of acorns are going to get left behind to start the new generation. They don't want to put out the same number of acorns every year, or the animal population will size itself to that amount of acorns. So brilliantly, every couple of years, they just go nuts with the acorns, so they're extra. And this kind of relationship in nature, this genius timing, these elaborate relationships, so intimate, so connected, to me, that's what's so fascinating and so beautiful about the natural world.
In what ways is your oak a witness for climate change?
This is the thing. You know, trees have an intimate relationship with the atmosphere. They connect the atmospheric and the terrestrial realms. That's one of the things that make trees so very, very special. And oaks, like any other tree, are made of carbon. That's how they grow. That's what their tissues are made of. They take carbon from the atmosphere in the process of photosynthesis with water, with sunlight, in this miraculous process, which, by the way, people have never been able to replicate in a lab. And they take the carbon in carbon dioxide, turn it into sugar, and build their tissues therefrom. So what do we know? We know that there's a lot more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere than, in fact, in the last 800,000 years, no human has ever breathed this atmosphere. We're at more than 400 ppm right now, and it used to be about 300 when my tree sprouted. So how has that affected the tree? Well, scientists at the Harvard Forest can actually answer that question. It's affected the tree in many ways that we can actually see. Number one, average temperatures surface are warmer by about 2 degrees Fahrenheit. Number two, the seasonal timing has shifted. Spring is earlier, fall is later. winter is getting squeezed on both ends, and the tree responds to temperature. It buds out earlier. It keeps its leaves on longer. But here's what these scientists at the Harvard Forest discovered. I thought this was so interesting. Number one, trees breathe through openings on the bottoms of their leaves called stomata, which is the Greek word for mouth, really rather beautiful. And with these mouths, trees are speaking truth, because here's what's going on. There's now so much CO2 in the atmosphere that they actually don't open their stomata as much. And the reason for that is they can get all the carbon they need without having to lose moisture through those pores if they don't have to. So this is the trade-off they're making. They're not opening those pores as much. They're getting just as much carbon as they used to. They're actually growing more efficiently because there's so much CO2 in the atmosphere. It's almost like a fertilizer for them. Using less water, growing faster. It sounds great, right? But that's for now. Who knows in the future if rainfall patterns change, if temperatures continue to escalate, maybe my tree won't be doing so well. But right now, red oak and other trees at the Harvard Forest are growing faster than ever. The other thing they discovered is that growing seasons are now so long, so supersized, that these leaves are falling off, even though the temperatures are still warm, even though the weather is still fine. We now have two seasons. We have the timing of living things, the seasons that they evolved with, and we have the seasons cooked up by us. And you have a mismatch between these man-made seasons and the actual seasons of living things. So going back to my oak tree, what we're seeing is that the leaves actually are not lasting as long as the seasons these days. I find that incredible, the idea of seasons lasting even longer than the leaves. It's expected that in time, the trees will adapt and, like their relatives further to the south, begin to take advantage of these longer growing seasons. But, you know, trees aren't fruit flies. They can't pump out a new generation in another couple of hours. It's going to be 100 years or maybe even longer. And so trees literally are scrambling to keep up with these changes in the atmosphere that are being made by us.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Linda Mapes, environmental reporter for the Seattle Times and author of the book, Witness Tree, Seasons of Change with a Century-Old Oak. To what extent do you view climate change differently as a result of your time with the Witness Tree in the Harvard Forest?
This absolutely changed my view of climate change. You know, we've all heard about it a lot, but for me it was a little bit abstract, a little bit remote. I thought it was something only going on up north with polar bears. But, you know, I'm a hiker. I'm a gardener. I definitely had a sense that the seasons were changing. Suddenly, the daffodils were up in January. That seemed awfully early to me. I knew something was going on, but I didn't know exactly what. And so to learn that what I sensed intuitively was no joke, it was very real, and that it wasn't only in my neighborhood, but as a matter of fact, it's everywhere, that was a breakthrough for me, to understand that what I felt and saw as a gardener, as a hiker, as a person, just in my neighborhood, that's the real thing. And it's happening right now. It's not some distant thing in some far off place. Climate change is very real, and it's right here and it's right now. And I think my year with my tree also made me understand the vulnerability, not only of species, but as a matter of fact, ourselves. I see us as perhaps the most vulnerable species of all. Life itself is the most powerful force on this earth. If the earth has to reset all the way back to rock and ice because we can't figure this out and we just, you know, keep pumping out the CO2 and cranking up the climate change, the earth will go on. But what would be really nice if we could figure out how to live on this earth in nature, because we are part of nature. We are embedded in this web of life. This beautiful earth to which we are so perfectly suited, if we could figure out how to break the link between comfort and prosperity and carbon so that all of us on this earth could live healthy, prosperous, interesting lives, that's the prize. We don't want to throw away our place on this earth, but believe me, the laws of physics apply universally, and we don't get some special pass, some special deal, you know, all the other species will go extinct, but we'll be okay. Doesn't work that way. We need a functioning, robust, living world or we're cooked.
Would you say more about the reforestation that's going on and its implications?
I found this so hopeful. You know, climate change is so often told as a gloom and doom story. But what I found at the Harvard Forest was hope, and here's why. Henry David Thoreau wrote at the height of deforestation in New England in about the 1860s. You know, people think of him as Pan with a pencil. He was actually lamenting the tree cutting that was going on all around him. He used to say, "Thank God they can't cut down the clouds." And he used to lament the so-called nobler animals that nobody saw anymore. Nobody had seen a deer in two generations. The biggest animal left was a muskrat. So that was in about the 1860s, which is also when big change came to New England, mostly, by the way, because of the opening of the Erie Canal. Suddenly, you had access to markets for those Midwestern farms with deep, beautiful soil, very different from these rocky little patches in New England where farmers were struggling to eke out what they could eke out. So there comes a gigantic transformation, impossible to overstate, in the six-state area of New England. People walk away from the farms or transition them to dairy operations, but no longer are they doing pasture and row crops. All those stone walls that you see laced through the forest today in this six-state area of New England, and in fact where I grew up, those are legacies of those farms. Those once were the boundaries between fields and interlaced all through the landscape, and they're still there today. But you know what's there now that wasn't there then? Trees. There has been a spectacular reforestation of this area in this six-state area of New England. It is one of the great rewildings of our time, and in fact, one of the great green hopes of our time. And with the return of the trees have come the animals. These animals that Thoreau was heartbroken he never saw anymore, they are back in such numbers they're virtual pests to people not used to living so closely with so much wildlife in their midst. Bears, especially, moose, especially, deer, everywhere. It's actually become an issue in some places in New England because they mow down the understory. You know, this is a transformation that is impossible to overstate, and it gives me great hope that nature, if given some space, given some time, comes roaring back. We've seen this with the Elwha River. We took down two dams on the Elwha, the largest dam removal project anywhere ever in the world, and the fish are booming back. And not only the fish, we see transformations in the bird life because now they have the food that they needed for the last 100 years. Dippers, those beautiful aquatic songbirds up in the Elwha Valley, they used to be migratory. They stick around now. They don't even leave. The females are bearing double clutches. They've got so much to eat and they're so fat and healthy. I find this incredibly hopeful, and it's very important to remember that many things, lots of things, are actually better today than they were in the time of Thoreau, in the time since my oak sprouted. And we have to remember that, fight for those things, hold on to those things that have made it better. Our understanding of science, our use of science for decision making, the protective laws that have been adopted that have cleaned up the air and the water and conserved the landscape. These are achievements of our parents and our grandparents, and we must hold on to these things and expand on them because you know what? They work.
Would you comment also on changes in the types of trees in the area around the Harvard Forest and the implications of those changes?
You know, some of the changes at the forest are troubling. There isn't only one story in the Harvard Forest or in any forest. My tree, the red oak, is doing great. It's growing faster than ever, as I mentioned earlier. However, just steps away are hemlock, beautiful eastern hemlock. This is a tree that is celebrated in New England. It's the tree of poetry. It's the tree of wintertime that gives you these beautiful fresh green boughs on sunny winter days. This tree is dying, and it's dying by the millions. And the reason it's dying is because of a little invasive pest called a woolly adelgid. They call it the woolly bully for a good reason. It's a small aphid-like insect, and it literally sucks the life out of trees. And this infestation is spreading. And you know why? Because the winters aren't as cold as they used to be. The killing cold is no longer a killing cold. And so because of that, you have a vast spread of this insect throughout New England. And it is predicted that within the next 20 years, every single hemlock in the Harvard Forest will be gone. And in its place will come black birch, a a deciduous tree, which will change the whole ecology of the forest. Because instead of this hemlock that very much dominates its grove and sets the temperature of the grove because of that dense, dense shade and sets the water regime of that grove, all of that's going to change. The bird life is going to change. It'll still be a forest, but it won't be the same forest. And a little bit of that native diversity of the New England wood will be lost. This bass note of green that sounded for 1,000 years will be gone.
What do you hope your book will accomplish?
I hope it opens people's eyes to the wonder of nature. I hope it kindles joy in the living world. I hope it gives people an appreciation for the trees that we walk by every day and just think they're just standing there. Boy, are they ever not just standing there. I mean, for one thing, they move, they breathe, they're omnisexual, by the way. An oak tree is both male and female at once. They have vast networks of communication below ground in their roots through mycorrhizal fungi. They're connected below ground, tree to tree, species to species. You know, they look so sedate and alone just standing there. Boy, hardly. It's a riot underground. There's all kinds of stuff going on. Mutualism, parasitism, sharing. I mean, it's wild down there. Up in the canopy, the same. You've got a vast suite of life up there, eating and flying and singing. And, you know, you've got insects on these urgent errands and you have birds. And it's spectacular. The life of even one tree. To know it well is to be completely dazzled.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Care for this world. Love this world. Enjoy it every single day. Its wonders, its diversity. If you were to take just one tree, one patch in your yard or in a place that you know and love well, pay close and deep attention to it. Watch it go through the seasonal gyre. Really listen to the life that you see there. Enjoy it richly. Enjoy it deeply. Pass that love on to your friends, your children. Really know that we're so fortunate to be on this beautiful earth. I think that we really need a tree culture. We need a political and social biomimicry of the genius of trees and forests. You see all these different species getting along, going through their day, helping one another, persisting for many, many, many years in the same place. Why can't we do that?
Well, thanks so much for being here, Linda.
Thank you.
You were just listening to Linda Mapes, environmental reporter for the Seattle Times and author of the book Witness Tree, Seasons of Change with a Century-Old Oak, published in 2017 by Bloomsbury. For more information, check on the web at lindavmapes.com. That's LyndaVMapes.com. Sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on demand, and then podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening. And be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on Listener Powered 90.3 FM by mobile app and on kexp.org.